Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, corporate media aren't in the business of challenging the idea that corporations are benevolent social actors who bring benefits to the communities lucky enough to have them. So even if Amazon didn't own a major newspaper, there was no reason to expect much by way of deep media criticism of the company's search for a second HQ, even as that led to cash-strapped U.S. cities falling over one another to offer tax breaks and subsidies to a corporation that paid zero federal taxes last year on profits of over $11 billion. Surprisingly, some media followed the lead of community organizers and questioned the deal, questions Amazon pulled out rather than engage. More surprisingly, the deal's end didn't end the questions. We'll hear that story from journalist Neil DeMoss, author of, most recently, The Brooklyn Wars. Also on the show, we may wish and work for a world in which countries don't have to rely on aid from the United States to fund critical social programs. But while the U.S. is a global aid provider, we're right to examine how that aid is employed. Does it build up or weaken, support or coerce? When it comes to global health funding, recent Republican presidents, but especially Donald Trump, have used aid to restrict women's health care and even the discussion of it, with effects that are as harmful as they are predictable. We'll talk about the fight back to that problem with Nina Besser-Dorley, Senior Program Officer in U.S. Foreign Policy at the International Women's Health Coalition. All of that's coming up this week on Counterspin. By the time Amazon chose New York and Virginia for its second headquarters in November, a funny thing had happened. People had been heard to question not just the value to a community of hosting an anti-union corporation known for worker exploitation and hawking facial recognition software to ICE, but the whole idea of cities competing with one another to attract companies with huge bundles of tax breaks and subsidies. In New York's case, a reported $3 billion worth. When Amazon abruptly pulled the deal off the table on February 14th, there were the anticipated grumbles about anti-corporate activists spoiling what would have been a great opportunity for jobs and growth and all things good. But there were also cheers, not only for standing up to Amazon's particular demands, but for challenging the idea of tax incentives and subsidies as a way to grow or govern healthy communities. Our next guest has been reporting these issues for years. Journalist Neil DeMoss reports for Gothamist. His most recent book is The Brooklyn Wars, but he's also co-author with Joanna Kagan of Field of Schemes, How the Great Stadium Swindle Turns Public Money into Private Profit. He joins us now by phone from San Francisco. Welcome back to Counterspin, Neil DeMoss.
Always a pleasure.
Well, we spoke about this in October of 2017 in the thick of the choose us unseemliness. It's been interesting, I think, to see the conversation kind of mature, because for many people, it wasn't whether the Amazon deal was the worst as these things go, but whether as these things go is some immutable model whose benefits aren't to be questioned. Well, New York Governor Andrew Cuomo gave the boilerplate argument, you know, the thing that's supposed to make you say, duh, you know, of course it's a good idea for New Yorkers to give billions of dollars in subsidies to a company because it's just simple math. You addressed that line in a Gothamist piece a few months back. What was Cuomo arguing and what's wrong with it?
I think when Amazon announced the DC suburbs and New York City as the two winners of its HQ2, although as a lot of people have pointed out, it's not really a headquarters if there's three of them. But the response in New York was not uniformly excited for a bunch of reasons, partly because of the $3 billion in tax breaks that were involved, and partly because they were talking about going into a neighborhood, Long Island City, that already is beset by overdevelopment and gentrification. And, you know, a lot of people were concerned about the impact on housing prices and things like that. And Governor Cuomo's response was to, as is kind of his style, to get a little huffy about it and to say, no, we're not giving Amazon $3 billion because they'll be paying $30 billion in taxes over the years. So really, it's like we're earning a 900% profit. And this was a very, very odd argument, which is what I tried to address in my Gothamist piece, because normally you don't think of people paying their taxes as a profit for cities, right? You know, people paying their taxes is just what they do in order to help contribute to all the things that keep a city running. So, you know, if Amazon was going to be paying $30 billion in taxes over the years, that's what you need in order to have trains to get the Amazon employees to work and schools for the Amazon employees' kids to go to and, you know, all the other things that city and state governments provide. But suddenly there was this idea of somehow, if you are giving someone a 10% tax break, that's really a 90% profit.
It still is said in the Daily News editorial, they basically said that that line makes a lot of sense and people were silly not to understand it. Basically, they didn't get what was going on here. And that also seems to be at work in the very idea that, you know, like it or not, this is the way you get companies to come to your community, you know, whether or not it really breaks down as a benefit, you know, completely in the ledger, still you want these companies to locate, you have to offer these subsidies. And there's questions to be asked about that, aren't there?
Sure. I mean, I think when you look at this whole Amazon sweepstakes, right, they got much bigger offers from a bunch of other states. New Jersey offered, I think, $7 billion. Maryland was, I think, a little bit more than that. And they turned them down because clearly they wanted to be in New York and Washington, D.C., which on the one hand, sure, it's great that New York only offered $3 billion instead of $8 billion. But on the other hand, did they even need to offer that, right? And, you know, it's how much are you leaving on the table by offering huge tax breaks to anybody who, you know, is willing to locate here? A lot of people pointed out that Google is right, opening a new, not headquarters, but larger facility, you know, adding a whole bunch of jobs and not asking for these levels of subsidies. And for another Gothamist article I recently researched, that not long ago they did an investigation of one of these tax breaks, you know, for companies relocating to New York City, and found, I think it was about, they calculated about in 3/4 of the cases, the company would have relocated anyway because it was already profitable and the subsidy was just icing on the cake.
And then if the idea is you want jobs or you want economic growth, there are also other ways that you could do that. You know, if the question is just how can we increase revenue, if that's the bottom line.
Absolutely. You know, and there's been a lot of criticism of people who've said, like, oh, we should take the $3 billion and spend it on transit or schools or something like that, because it's not $3 billion we're going to have, right? Because it's just a tax break. So therefore, it's different kind of money you're giving away than if you were taking it out of the state or city treasury. But really, it's the same thing. I mean, you can make a great argument that improved schools or improved transit is an economic investment in the same way that bringing Amazon to New York City is, because if you have better schools, more companies and more individuals are going to want to live in New York because the schools will be better. And if you have better subways, more people are going to want to live and work in New York because, you know, you won't have to be trapped on a train for 2 hours in the morning when it breaks down.
Right.
But nobody looks at those kind of expenses as investments in your city and investments in your economy, whereas somehow when it's giving money to a large corporation, that's suddenly, well, this isn't really an expense or a giveaway. This is an investment.
And that view that you mentioned about investing in other things, that is the perspective that a number of community groups, I think, were trying to put forward. You know, the papers are attributing Amazon's pullout to politicians' pushback, which, of course, is very real. And the name of State Senator Michael Giannaris comes up a lot, along with Ocasio-Cortez. But those politicians are responding to community, you know, to groups like Align and Make the Road and Immigrant and Labor and People of Color and Students and Queens residents coalitions, you know, who had concerns about gentrification, as you pointed, that the jobs they suspected that were offered would not materialize or would not necessarily be jobs for locals. But they aren't saying we don't want any new businesses. They're saying in part that they want to be at the table. And I just wanted to ask you, the secrecy and the lack of public oversight has been such an element of this process from the beginning, hasn't it?
Yeah, well, that was Amazon's plan from the beginning, right, was to conduct this bidding war among cities and states. And in the initial rounds, cities and states weren't even allowed to reveal what they were bidding, to try to keep everything hidden until the deal was done sort of under the table and then presented as a fait accompli to the public. And I think one thing that Amazon and presumably other companies have learned is that that doesn't go over very well, because you had, for example, the New York City Council upset that they were cut out of this deal because the state was going to take control of it and not give the city council any say. And obviously you had the public and, you know, all of these community groups that have really been spending the last decade or more gearing up for a fight over increased housing costs, which are out of control in New York, out of, you know, the city and state giving priority and funding to these sort of big mega projects as opposed to, you know, other sort of more community-friendly projects or small businesses or any even number of things you could think of. And I think one of the things that's interesting about what the strategies were and what was successful is the one thing that Amazon really didn't realize was that people were going to go after it, not just for the subsidies, but for the rest of its business. Right. And, you know, from all the reporting that we've seen since Amazon pulled out, it really does seem like they were offended that anyone would criticize them on their anti-union policies or on their partnering with ICE on anti-immigrant policies. Yeah. So it was remarkably successful as a grassroots campaign to target Amazon's credibility and its status as a good company. And I think it's very interesting that Amazon pulled out saying, yeah, we thought we were going to get the money anyway. We just didn't want to have to face all these questions.
Well, that's an excellent tip for community organizers and for reporters as well, who questions are meant to be your stock in trade. There is now actual legislation to do with cities and communities offering tax incentives and competing with one another. There's a sense that states need to get together on this or it's not going to work. Do you see much hope in terms of this whole idea of beating back the very use of these subsidies as ways to lure corporations?
I think certainly New York State and other states could be looking at legislation to scale back some of these subsidy programs, to investigate whether they are actually doing anything positive, whether the public is getting a good bang for their buck. And I think in terms of some of these interstate compacts that people are talking about, it's a great idea, but it's really hard to enforce, right? Because if 10 states get together and say, we're not going to offer tax breaks in order for companies to locate in our states, then the other 40 can just say, oh, okay, great for us. We're going to go and do that instead. And it's hard to have a non-aggression pact when you don't have everybody on board, which is why I think most people think that the federal government really needs to be involved. And it would be trivially easy for Congress to put an end to all these local level corporate subsidy wars tomorrow. There was a bill in Congress 20 years ago now that would have just placed a high tax on any local level corporate subsidies. So if Amazon gets $3 billion in tax breaks from New York City, then they have to pay, I don't know, $1 billion or $2 billion or $3 billion, you could make it, in federal taxes, which, you know, completely eliminates any benefit that they would get from that and eliminates any benefit they would get from trying to, you know, stage one of these bidding wars. That bill didn't get anywhere in 1998, and I don't think it would come close to passing today. But the fact that, you know, we're talking about this and that, again, the media is sort of slowly starting to grapple with some of these issues, was at least a promising sign that maybe the heyday of massive tax breaks for any company that can threaten to leave town or threaten not to come to your town, we're starting to see a light at the very end of the tunnel.
We've been speaking with journalist Neil DeMoss. You can find his recent work on Amazon and other issues on Gothamist.com. There's more work on DeMoss.net. Neil DeMoss, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
My pleasure.
Put in effect in 1984 by Ronald Reagan, the Mexico City policy prevents foreign organizations that receive U.S. government funding from performing abortions, even if they are using funds from non-U.S. government sources, and even if abortion is completely legal in their country. But it's better known as the Global Gag Rule because it does more. preventing funding for agencies that counsel, refer, or advocate for abortion, forcing NGOs and healthcare providers to choose between crucial resources and their ability to provide the best care for their patients, including speaking freely about the full range of safe legal options. The rule has been revoked and reinstated as the White House has changed parties until Donald Trump, on his first full day in office, not only put it back, but expanded it categorically. Now the gag rule applies not just to family planning funding, but to all global health funding, some $9 billion a year worth of aid, including that going to projects fighting HIV/AIDS and malaria. Will Donald Trump's yet again making a bad thing worse be enough to generate some real scrutiny on this harmful policy? And is proposed new legislation a way to real change? We're joined now by Nina Besser-Dorley. She's Senior Program Officer in U.S. Foreign Policy at the International Women's Health Coalition. She joins us by phone from Washington, D.C. Welcome to Counterspin, Nina Besser-Dorley.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, I wonder if you could tell us some of what we already knew about the impacts of the global gag rule even before Donald Trump's expansion of it, which is obviously very, very significant. But even before that, we do have a record. There is evidence of the impact of this gag rule, isn't there?
Yeah, absolutely. What we've seen under previous incarnations of this policy is that it has led to a reduced access to services. It's made it harder for women to access a complete spectrum of reproductive health care, including abortion, but also contraception and other really critical reproductive health services. It's also had a really chilling effect on civil society. It's limited how organizations can collaborate with each other, what organizations who do sign the gag rule and accept U.S. government funding with the conditions, what they can participate in. And so it's had these really wide-ranging effects. There's one really interesting study from Stanford University that looked at the Bush administration, George W. Bush administration's gag rule, and found that it led to clinic closures, it led to reduced services, it led to reduced access to contraceptives. And in turn, it led to an increase in abortions in sub-Saharan Africa, which is where the study looked.
Well, it's interesting that it would lead to an increase in abortions. It's interesting if you think, oh, but wait, I thought it was, you know, anti-abortion, but it's really not confusing. If you cut off access to birth control, well, that's going to have certain repercussions. So in a way, it makes a certain kind of sense if you don't go at it thinking that abortion somehow is isolated from the rest of reproductive health care.
Yeah, absolutely. This policy does nothing to reduce the amount women need abortion services. It just makes those services harder to access and harder to access in safe and legal settings.
Well, and now we see Donald Trump expanding this to where it's not just about family planning funding, but all healthcare funding. I've read that in some places, like in the Netherlands, they're trying to do their own fundraising to try and fill the gap, but they just don't think it's anywhere near possible to match the funding that groups will lose if they decide not to sign on to this gag rule. I mean, it was bad before, but this really does take things up an order of magnitude, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's absolutely true. So in previous versions of this policy, it applied only to family planning and reproductive health funding. So if you took those categories of funding, you had to abide by the conditions of this policy. And that's a pot of money that's about $500 million a year. Significant and important. But what we're talking about now is the Trump administration has applied this to all global health funding, which is something upwards of $9 billion a year. And the U.S. is the largest funder of global health worldwide. And these are gaps that can't be made up by other donors.
Well, you talked about the sort of ripple effect. It can be difficult to convey to people because it's at a community level, right, where a clinic that provides comprehensive care, they do lots of things, may have to close. And, of course, that's going to affect everybody and not only pregnant women, but also societal level groups that might want to advocate to their own government for freer access to abortion now don't have this funding that might be needed to support themselves, you know? So it really affects the climate of conversation within these countries.
Yeah, it really does. And, you know, we're talking about now groups that accept HIV funding, groups that get funding for TB programs, groups that get funding for non-communicable diseases. And in many cases, it's exactly as you paint it. There's one clinic that provides all of these services. They may take funding for, say, TB. And now they're in a country where abortion is legal and where they were previously providing that as part of their package of reproductive health care. They're forced to choose. Are they going to forego the TB funding and no longer be able to provide those services to the people in the community who count on them? Or are they going to continue to accept that funding and no longer be able to offer the comprehensive set of reproductive health care that is legal in their country and that, you know, women in the community were relying on? And these are really painful decisions for providers and for organizations that are put in this position to make this call.
Yeah, I would just underscore, you know, by this rule, groups that advocate for more or freer access to abortion can't get funding. But if they're advocating for restrictions on abortion, they can still get funding. So in terms of affecting just the conversational climate, well, I think when folks are thinking about domestically, we might remember Henry Hyde in pushing the Hyde Amendment, which means that women can't use Medicaid funding for abortion. But I want to remind about how he said in 1977, quote, "I certainly would like to prevent, if I could legally, anybody having an abortion, a rich woman, a middle-class woman, or a poor woman. Unfortunately, the only vehicle available is the Medicaid bill," close quote. I think, in a sense, there are things that folks can't do domestically that they can do through aid programs. And for other countries, it's very obvious that this is an ideological thing and that it doesn't have anything to do with medicine or safety or women's well-being or economic growth or anything like that. I feel like we have to kind of call it out for what it is, right? Which has to do much more with control over women than with concerns about health care.
And I think it's really important to note that this administration is trying to bring this policy home. They have a draft HHS regulation that's currently being finalized. I've heard it could be out any day now, that looks to impose a very similar version of a gag rule to Title X funding in this country. And it's not a coincidence that, you know, they rolled this policy out in the global sphere, in the foreign assistance sphere, which, as you mentioned, is sort of easier to see as over there and not about us. They rolled that out right at the beginning of the administration. And now, a couple of years in, they're pushing much harder to implement the same agenda and the same ideology in their domestic policy.
Well, the thing is, though, that most Americans do still want women to have the right to choose when and if they give birth. Senator Jeanne Shaheen told BuzzFeed right after Trump's initial move, "If you're doing it to try and limit abortion, if you're doing it to try and support stronger families and healthier children and mothers, it does none of those things." You know, talking about the gag rule, Representative Nita Lowey said that the new policy, the expansion of the gag rule, doesn't make any sense, and that irrationality might be the biggest concern, you know, because maybe they don't even realize the impact that this is going to have. Shaheen and Lowy, of course, are co-sponsors of something called the Global Health Empowerment and Rights, or HER Act. How is that legislation, how would that be responsive to the problem that we're talking about?
The Global HER Act would legislatively solve this problem, both in the immediate and the long term. It would take away the president's ability to put this policy into effect. So it would basically say that organizations who provide legally permissive abortion services are eligible to receive U.S. government funding. It would take away the possibility of using that as a criteria to not fund organizations. And I think this is really important because it's important that we end this policy now, but because it's gone back and forth between Republican and Democratic administrations, it has impacts in Global South countries, even when it's not in place, because it's really hard for organizations, particularly small community-based organizations, to completely reframe and reassess their health programming based on the whims of whoever's in power in Washington. So this legislation is really important because it would permanently end the global gag rule.
Well, I actually meant to mention that, you know, it almost goes without saying, but of course you have to say it. And there's a new book called Crow After Roe that kind of evokes it. When access to abortion is restricted, people are affected differently, you know, and poor and rural and women of color bear the brunt. And what I hear you saying is that happens even when it's just a threat or even when it's just hanging over people's heads. It already has that impact, and that impact is felt differently by different communities.
Absolutely. I mean, my organization has started a project documenting the impacts of Trump's version of the global gag rule, and that's one of the first things that came out of that research and documentation effort is that it is the people who already have the hardest time accessing health care, whether it's young people, rural people, LGBT communities, other marginalized groups. It's those communities that feel the effects of this first, as clinics that they trust start to close, as places that they have access to begin to lose funding and have to scale down services. Those are the people who feel these impacts first and most acutely.
Well, let me just ask you finally, what is the situation with the Global HER Act? It has, it's, I believe, a great deal of support that is bipartisan. What should we be looking for in days ahead in terms of that legislation?
I think it's really important to note that versions of this legislation have passed both the Senate Appropriations Committee on a bipartisan vote last year and the full House earlier this year, again, as part of an appropriations vote. So we're really close. You know, and I think it's going to be critical in the coming weeks and months to really bring to bear the stories of impact that we already have, the evidence we've already gathered around the impacts of these policies, to really bring to Congress a full picture of exactly how devastating this policy, and particularly this Trump version of the policy, is in communities to help push that bill ahead.
We've been speaking with Nina Besser-Dorley. She's Senior Program Officer in U.S. Foreign Policy at the International Women's Health Coalition. They're online at IWHC.org. Her article with Vanessa Rios, "The Global Gag Rule Has Put Women in Danger for Decades, Here's How We Can Stop It," can be found at rewire.news. Nina Besser-Dorley, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. For more information, check out our website, fair.org. The show's engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.